Yes, I think it affected the marketability in the third market because if we believed in a company, we traded in it and we felt we were there to give a service as a market maker. And I don't necessarily think every firm takes that attitude. I think they look at the profitability of its trading, which is probably a very important factor, but we didn't always regard it that way.
Were you moving premises during the 60s and 70s, or were you always in the same place?
We were always in Wolford Court, yes. We were on the third floor in Wolford Court. I think we did change offices across the corridor, but that was nothing dramatic in that, other than getting the communications up and running. But we'd always been in Wolford Court, which of course was very convenient to walk across the Throgmorton Street or straight onto the floor.
And did you start introducing new equipment, for example, like computers, into the office at some point?
Brother John eventually got the computers when it was moving fast this way. I think the only machinery we had in the office in the early days was the contometer, which was even that was a dramatic thing to have installed. And the telephone system got updated. I think in the early days, whatever you put in was out of date by the time it was fully connected. But I think again, my father's influence here, he hated computers. He liked to be able to turn a jobber's ledger up and see what trade you'd done with that particular firm. And everything was there. I think he always had this fear with computers that something could get wiped out and there was no trace at all of a whole fortnight's training, which was something that was totally unacceptable to him. Mm. Well, then, of course, there was backups and all sorts of things that were introduced. And I think it would have been impossible on, the BT issue. You could never have coped with it, really. Mm. Although, on that particular issue, all the partners, all the dealing staff turned to and became the office boys. And we helped to prepare all the allotment letters for settlement. And we were just doing the very menial jobs. But we kept, everything was up to date, and we never had any problems with that at all. And the beneficial thing was that we could see that the volume wasn't, the profit wasn't justified against the volume of trading, because you would sell 100,000 shares and the small pieces that you were buying them in and the paperwork involved was absolutely horrific. Mm. And as a result of that, the next large issue of its type, we decided not to do it. Because a small firm as we were, there was no way that we could cope with it efficiently. Mm. And so we were one of the first market makers to start widening our prices out. And I firmly believe to this day we were one of the few jobbers that actually kept the profit we made on day one. Most of the other jobbers went on trading and getting closer and closer in their prices. And I think they lost a lot of money in that particular stock at that time. So our lesson was that the volume the settlement side was quite horrendous. Mm. They did alter the settlement system on this particular issue, because you were allowed to deliver your allotment letters the night before, which enabled the market maker to process them to get them ready to deliver them the next day on to. So in fact, we didn't have to pay for the stock and then arrange for it to be re-delivered. We actually took delivery without paying for it, and then this was a tremendous help to the system. I don't think anybody probably would have coped if it hadn't been done that way. Mm-hmm. I remember I went out to arrange some overdrafts, and because I could see this was going to be a little bit of a problem. And 2 days later, when we started thinking about it, because I think we were trading for 8 days before anything settled, which was, and you could see the way the business was building up, that it was going to be quite a huge settlement. Mm. So we went round the bank and doubled our facilities for borrowing. And in fact, we never used a shilling of it, because this delivering it the night before and processing it was a tremendous help. Mm. So anyway, that was quite an experience.
Generally, did you have a good relationship with the bank?
Excellent, yes. It was rather funny because when we first formed, Father and I went round to NatWest Bank Lothbury, who shall be nameless, and where E.S. Godden originally banked, and we introduced ourselves as the new partners in the firm. And they said, oh, we're very pleased to meet you, and we'll be reviewing your account in 6 months' time. And the next time Father and I actually went round the bank was about 12 years later. And it was when the bank were trying to get to know their customers, and Father and I both went round, and we spoke to the manager, and we said, well, you know, we're a bit disappointed in you. You did say you wanted to see us after 6 months, and they just couldn't believe it. We hadn't been round there, so obviously the account had been monitored and was satisfactory, and the profits had obviously increased over the years. So we had a very good relationship, only because they never spoke to us, really. But in the latter years, we did their securities department, and I think that their attitude. There was one it wasn't a criticism; it was an observation. NatWest Bank's stock office. NatWest Bank was the only one of the big five that had their stock office in their headquarters. All the other banks, your Lloyds, Midlands, Barclays, all had their own stock offices in their own individual way. And I often felt that NatWest missed out on this. I don't think they had such a close relationship as perhaps some of the other banks. But anyway, that's... But anyway, yes, we never had any problems with them. They were always very, very helpful. And mainly, I think, because we used to go around and discuss a problem before it happened. In fact, when we went round to discuss this first overdraft for BT, the manager there said, well, he said, you're the first jobber to come in and ask for these facilities, which must have been good for him because it must have alerted him that there was going to be some others knocking on his door. But as it happened, that particular incident wasn't necessary.
Did you ever find capital a problem?
Not really, no, because when the turnover started increasing and the profits went with it, we then did go to NatWest Bank to discuss our overdraft situation, and we went to Shepherd's for our stock borrowing, and the usual situation. They've obviously examined our balance sheets, and they were quite satisfied that we had our whatever facilities we want, they were there. It was never a problem.
How would you describe the markets in which you were trading as a firm, Leisure Entertainments? Were they generally good markets, or did they go up and down?
They were fairly stable, I would say, most of the time. They were good trading stocks, actually, because everybody needs leisure. It's always a commodity that's always required. It's a bit like dentists and hairdressers. And it always enjoyed, from a trading point of view, the companies always enjoyed a very good period, which again, I think, reflected in the market. And it wasn't unusual that somebody would go on holiday with perhaps Horizon and say, oh, I like the way this company's run, I might buy a few shares. And I think that they had their own... They manufactured their own shareholders in a roundabout way. It was quite a stable market to trade in, and they were all household names as well. It was rather strange because at sort of Christmas time, Butlins and Pontins would be advertising their summer holidays, and it wouldn't be unusual in January for the leisure section in the holiday camp section the shares to start moving a bit better, only because they were. Being seen on television, and people will often say, "Oh, that must be a good company to invest in," and that's the way it went.
I've been told that in the earlier period, the leisure market was one in which there were many shop brokers operating. Was that true of the later period? Or true, for example, of the 1960s?
Do you mean they were represented by? Trust House Fort, I think, had three brokers. There was Greenwell, James Capel, and one other, which escapes me for the moment. But in the days of when we say that we didn't have insider trading, I mean, if a company wanted to put its own shares better to for a takeover situation. There was nothing to stop directors of the company coming in to buy their shares to make them better. It wasn't terribly sophisticated in those days, where one could, and especially if it was with the jobbers' cooperation. You know, if he said, "Look, we've got a deal on at the moment. We'd like these shares better." There was no rules to say you shouldn't do it. I think there were rules brought in eventually that we won't use the word rigging of markets, but there was another word for it. But that's really what. I think that happened quite often in the 50s and the 60s. Mm. Because companies themselves were young and they wanted to expand. Mm. When you think Pontins must have taken over at least four other major companies in that field, and so they were building up their own empires, really. I can remember when I worked for Thomson Schwab when Sears were trying to buy Scottish Motor Traction, and this comes back to illustrating how bad the communications were. The notice went up on the board that the directors of Scottish Motor Traction were divesting themselves of their assets, and I looked at the top, and the piece of paper was issued by Streets, number one Royal Exchange, and I was told to write this down verbatim, and there was two pages of it, A4 size, and I thought, well, it's impossible. So I nipped over to Streets and I said that, look, I've got this problem, and the short story was they let me actually have a copy of it, which was very rare, and I dashed that down to my governor in Throgmorton Avenue, and that was put in with a messenger in a taxi, and he went straight up to Charlie Clark's office, wherever, and he was on a plane going north within sort of another hour or so, and they got in an injunction against the directors to stop them disposing of the assets while this bid was on. So there was a little bit of infighting in the early days. As I say, there was nothing to stop people putting their shares better or manipulating the markets to their advantage. It was permissible, I suppose, if that's the right phraseology. And I don't think it ever actually came out. Nobody ever stopped to think about whether it was happening or not happening. Perhaps we were all a bit naive in those days. I suspect we were, really. The other way to disguise bargains, of course, was for London persons to put their buying orders or selling orders through a country broker. They instruct their Manchester broker to do something, who would in turn deal back through London, and the bargains got lost somewhere along the line. And I suppose eventually this got moved to Swiss banks and Jersey banks, and it was followed in a more sophisticated way. But yes, there's some of my earlier recollections in that direction.
Were you very conscious of the jobbing system changing during the 60s and 70s? Did you ever think in those terms?
No, I don't. It wasn't obvious that it was changing. Mm. I tried to introduce one or two things in the firm because brokers were requiring more and more information. They weren't just interested in what the price was. They'd want to know what the dividend was, what the yields were, what the cover was. And I introduced in a small way into the firm so that we were had a better backing on knowledge of the companies, which I think the larger firms have been doing for quite some time. You could turn a jobbing book up and there was the yield spread, the price spread and dividend cover, and it was all there. If a broker relied on the jobbers in the early days, he's got a client on the phone and he says, "Look, what are so-and-so, what do you think to them, what's the dividend, when's it due?" And if you could rattle all this off to him, you were doing half his job for him. And if he did get any inquiry, the chances are you'd probably do his business for him. So I did introduce one or two things in this area. And also sort of early warning system on new issues, when the calls were due and last day for splitting, because this all influenced your trading on the floor. Well, we tried to get a little bit more sophisticated in this area. And then, of course, we took the exchange telegraph cards, which were very, very useful in those days. So, but the actual the jobbing, the actual jobbing thing itself, I don't think really changed. It was always the same. Mm. I don't think jobbing really changed, even with decimalisation. Mm. That didn't. I remember going to the meeting on that. Jock Hunter took the chair. Esmond Dolacker called the meeting, and all the senior partners or representatives of all the market makers attended this meeting. I've got a feeling it was in Messel's office, I think, in Winchester House in those days. Well, I think that's where it was. Anyway, we all went round there and prior to decimalisation, and there was a discussion that they wanted to make a firm commitment how we were going to trade in the new market, you know, in with the currency changing as such. And one chap wanted to deal in tenths of a penny on the basis that it would suit the new computerised world that was eventually going to surround us. And it was going on and on and on, and I eventually thought, well, we're not getting anywhere. So I stood up, and I was very junior. I mean, there was a lot of very senior people there, and I was just really the boy, a tradesman, and said that, well, Mr. Chairman, I'd propose that we carry on dealing in quarters and halves as we've always done. I said, I think it'll be less confusing for the more senior members. And I must confess, I didn't realise the difference in the profit, because a farthing old money was £1.10, a farthing new money was £2.50. So the jobbing turn was going to go up quite horrific. And I sat down, and there's a chap sitting next to me who was with Pinchin. His name escapes me for the moment. He got a dig in the rib from his governor and said, "You'll second Mr. Jenkins' proposal." And up he popped, and I like second him, and he said, I don't think he knew what he was doing either. And the chairman waffled on a bit. He said, "Well, okay, gentlemen, if you'd like to go away now and discuss this with your partners." And up popped Mr. Powell, and he said, "Well, Mr. Chairman, you've had a proposal and a seconder." He said, "I suggest if you don't have any amendments, you put it in the meeting." Oh, well, all those in favour, and that was it. It all finished, and that's how it all happened. And my claim to fame, I suppose, really. But I didn't realise how much it was. I hadn't actually sat down and worked it out of mathematical how much better off we were going to be. Mm. But so many things were accepted, you know, sort of in those days.
Did the jobbers continue to meet whenever the occasion demanded?
Yes, I mean, you could have a meeting if you, you know, for whatever reason, mainly on new issues, or if somebody wanted to take up a stock. I think one of the things that's partly ruined the jobbing, if we call it the jobbing system, or the marketability of stocks, there's too many jobbers in a stock. I mean, we reckon 3 to 4 jobbers maximum on a small type company. Obviously on your ICIs, you know, you can have 10 jobbers, as many as you liked, really. Mm-hmm. There'll probably still, out of that 10, there'll only be 4 that will be really in the market. And I always maintain that too many jobbers in a market could ruin the marketability. It just won't move around. It's just an actual fact. There's too many elements pulling against one another, I think. And you'll finish up that none of them would want to make a market, and you finish up with 6 jobbers non-market making in them. And I think this is probably one of the problems that's happened with all this exposure on the screens. Mm. People did spoil themselves and spoil one another, the opposition, now and again, but it was not something that went on all the time. And I think this has been one of the problems. Why people ever thought that you've got 20 market makers in the stock, that they were going to carry on or increasing the profit, the overall profit on the market making side, it was just not on. The cake was only one size, and yeah. And it just wasn't going to get any larger. Mm. In fact, I think it's proved detrimental, I think. Mm. Not only to the market makers, the jobbers, but I think to the general public as a whole as well. Mm. I don't think it's been any benefit whatsoever.
Mm. Well, you've said that before 86, the actual technique of jobbing didn't change.
No.
Were you conscious of the number of jobbers becoming fewer, the number of jobbing firms becoming fewer? Did that seem to affect?
Well, not really. I mean, I knew it in terms of numbers, because when S. Jenkins formed in 1960, there were 62 jobbing firms. I always remember that as a mile mark, if you like, milestone. In 1946, when I first went in the market, I think overall there was probably about 300. So I noticed the change of the market makers shrinking. I wouldn't necessarily think that we did any more trade as a result of that, because I mean, WED were made up of probably 10 firms, all in various markets. In fact, some of the amalgamations were, we were lucky that the small jobbers were lucky that the large market makers were there, because one or two of the small jobbers got into some serious financial problems, and the large jobbers, to keep an orderly market, just moved in, took them over and took their positions over. There could have been some really disastrous situations of firms that are over-trading, in a sense. I think one or two jobbers in the gilt market over-traded, and they were bailed out, probably bailed out by Mullins, the government broker. But I think when they did it the third time, I think they said, well, enough's enough. And it was one of those unusual situations where a firm ceased trading without being hammered. They just didn't come down. It was quite an eerie thing, really, because most jobbers were on their pitches at, say, 9:15, waiting for the trade. And there was one particular firm in the gilt market. It 9:20, they weren't there, and 9:25, they weren't there. No blue buttons, nobody cleaning the board. And at 9:30, there wasn't anybody. And at 9:25, and it was 9:45 when the stock exchange put out an official statement that they had, I think the phraseology was ceased trading, and that was it. I mean, from a point of view, it's much better that the member firms are now monitored on their trading, and it's much better that they be shut down as a going concern rather than hammered, which I always used to think was a more expensive way of doing it. I always thought there was a different way of doing it, but that was the system. It was final, really. Quite an eerie thing when the waiters used to bang the gavel on stand 10 and stand 11. They used to do it simultaneously. Gentlemen, I think we regret to announce that Mr. So-and-so, trading as, have failed to comply with their bargains. And that was it. That's finished. And then there's always this in the early days with no means of communication, a great scurry away onto the telephones to inform your office, who then had to prepare all the positions that were open on a sheet, and they were submitted to the official assignee, and for make-up prices. That was the start of the finish, as it were, of a firm.
What were make-up prices?
Well, when a firm were hammered, they've got a lot of bargains opened, still open. They've bought 1,000 shares at £1 from a jobber, and it's not fully certain whether the client will settle that bargain. So on the actual hour of the hammering, or whatever, the actual time of the hammering, the official assignee will come round. Once he's got the listing from the market makers, he would come round and say, well, what were Butlins, what's the hammer price for Butlins? And if they were, might be 19 shillings. Now, there's a difference of a shilling a share on the make-up price and the bargain price. So that's actually closed that price down in that account. So there's a difference on the jobber's ledger account now of a shilling a share. That's settling the inter-stock exchange deal. Now, you've submitted your list to the official assignee, who's now moved into the broker's office, and he identifies that bargain with a client. And he will give you the name and address of that client. And one of the few occasions when a jobber or market maker would write to a member of the general public, because until that sort of situation, you were not allowed to communicate with them. And then you write to Mr. Brown and say, this 1,000 shares in Butlins you've bought, do you wish to pay for them? Or whatever is done, or do you wish the bargain to be closed? And you give him the option of what he wants to do. And then you settle direct with him. It may be that another broker will take over certain clients' bargains, and you would settle through the other broker. But that would be how it would. That's the way a hammering would be settled, and the hammer prices would be up on the official assignee's board for anybody that's got any queries.
Do you remember times when there were many hammerings, or were they not occasional?
Not in my time, but I think Mr. O'Hearn will probably tell you a time when the rattle went at 3:30. It must have been in those days when nobody was hammered after 3:30, and somebody said, "Well, thank goodness the rattle's gone, they can't hammer any more today." And this evidently was in the mining market, where you've got this trace going on. The jobber, the trace always stops at the jobber, or the next firm he's traded at. Well, there was a whole string of bargains in the mining market, and several mining market jobbers were all hammered on the same day. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were, but I know that my father always said that they said, thank goodness when the rattle went at 3:30, they can't hammer any more today. And probably not a lot of money involved. You know, I think Tingey Basket, when they were hammered, I think the total amount of money was sort of £25,000. And yet you'll have other firms where it's £1.5 million, you know. It's really is big money, which is, some of it's recoverable, but not necessarily all of it. But of course, on a hammering, once you've signed the authorisation to the official assignee, which is in fact what we term a city undertaker or a liquidator, then he moves in and takes all your assets. He'll take your anything, you know, he'll take the house, the car, and it's quite a final, it's quite a final thing, quite dramatic.
Who normally acted as the S&E?
He's appointed by the stock exchange. He's a full-time person in the stock exchange. He was known as the Rat, and his name was R.A. Thompson, but his initials were Rat. He was the last one I know. I think there was one after him, but then it was done more as an office rather than as an individual. But I mean, it's not only dramatic. I did visit somebody that was hammered the day after. To give him some advice, and he was in a very, very distressed state.
Was this a jobber?
Broker friend of mine. And although, you see, it's always considered hammering is a collective thing. If it doesn't matter whether you're the guilty party or not. I mean, if you've got a partner that's been fiddling and has caused the firm to shut down, you are just as guilty as him because you are in partnership with him. So you go under with him. And this particular fellow, I remember visiting him and his family. I think he had three children, you know, the dog and the goldfish, all the normal commitments of a young married man. And it was quite distressing, you know. People think it's very dramatic, the hammer banging, but if you see the distress behind it all, it's not really very funny at all. It's a very sad time. And particularly because you would have known most of them. You'd have probably grown up with them, you know, as well. But it doesn't. I don't think it works like that now. I think they've got a different system, and I think it's probably a good thing. Like if there's a problem arriving at a firm, well, then they just shut them down. It's less dramatic, and I think it's probably a better way of doing it. I remember we were on holiday once. We were on the Norfolk Broads. I go on a bachelor holiday with my friends. Well, the funny thing, having said I don't associate with them, I'd forgotten about this, and I've been going up there 30-odd years. And there's six of us, and five are stock exchanges, there's one odd one out. And we were sailing down this river going towards Barton Broad, and we were listening to the news, 10 o'clock news, what it was, and it said, five London stockbrokers are hammered. Well, you're thinking in terms of firms rather than individuals, and we thought five firms, and because no walkie-talkie phones or anything like that, and we eventually got to Stalham, and we managed to phone in there, and it turned out the firm was EJ Marks, and there was five partners, and they were the five brokers hammered. But one visage that there was one firm had failed, and it rippled on, and. In fact, one of those partners paid up and got his membership back, because you lose your membership immediately. In fact, the other case I'm talking about, where the chap I went to visit, he paid off his debts, and applied for his membership and got it back again. Mm. So there are occasions where they do come back. Mm. It's the exception to the rule now.
Mm. Leaping or changing the subject slightly, thinking now about jobbing during the late 70s, early 80s, did you feel there was any pressure on single capacity? There was any pressure on it to change and to adopt a different system of trading?
Not really, no. As a small firm, we never felt threatened or vulnerable. It was only getting towards the mid-80s when I personally felt that... I think the thing that spurred me on to sell out, it was the first time ever in the history of London Stock Exchange we actually had something to sell. In the early years, all you had was whatever money you got in your current account, and that was the finish of it. When you retired, you took your money out of your current account and off you went, or your capital account. You didn't sell the business to your fellow partners or anything. You just left with what you'd got. And this was the first time that we'd actually been able to sell our business. And I thought, well, having been up there nearly 40 years, I thought, well, this is a good time to take this very, very seriously. And I suppose my age was more of an influence on it, whereas my brother, who's 17 years younger than me, it probably didn't appeal to him so much. But I thought it was a good opportunity to actually cash in, particularly as I was sort of thinking about I'd like to retire, and I thought I'd